Welcome. I'm Angie Cuero, and this is Your Call. Rose Aguilar is on vacation. It was bad enough the Republican vice presidential candidate championed baseless racist rumors about Haitians in Ohio, that they were stealing dogs, cats, and geese to cook and eat. It got worse when Donald Trump amplified the lies during the presidential debate and again at a press conference. That, too, encouraged his running mate, J.D. Vance, to stand by those claims, saying he was willing to, quote, create stories so that the American media actually pays attention. In other words, it's okay to lie. Lest there be any confusion, these immigrants are here with the blessing of the U.S. government. As The Guardian reports, Haiti is one of 16 countries granted temporary protective status, TPS, because of the ongoing conflict, making it easier for immigrants to get authorization to work in the U.S. As President Trump tried to end TPS for Haiti and referred to the country as, perhaps you'll remember this, an S-hole. And from Colorado Public Radio, Biden administration allowed Venezuelans who came to the U.S. by July 31st last year to apply for TPS, which would give them a reprieve from deportation and allow them to work for 18 months. The administration explained its decision to extend the opportunity by saying, their home country is suffering one of the worst humanitarian crises in the history of the Western Hemisphere. Springfield authorities, including the police, have repeatedly denied any pets are being eaten. And that didn't stop the House Judiciary GOP from tweeting a picture of Trump embracing a kitten and a duck with the plea, protect our ducks and kittens in Ohio. A little later this hour, we'll talk with political rhetoric expert Jennifer Mechia about how this kind of thing gains purchase publicly and whether any effective ways exist to combat it. First, though, let's look into what the Haitian and Venezuelan immigrants are dealing with and who's picking up the challenge of helping them and defending them. Let me bring on our guest. Kaylee Leon is the North Regional Organizer for the Colorado Immigrants' Right Coalition.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Zachary Mueller is on the line, too. He's the Senior Research Director for America's Voice.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with both of you in terms of what your organizations have been doing. They've both raised alarms over the statements from Trump about the immigrant communities in Colorado and Ohio. So, Kaylee, I want to start with you. Talk a little bit more about what the coalition is seeing and what its specific concerns are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We have had a lot of, people come to us specifically from the Venezuelan community, right? Speaking about the fear that they've been feeling, right? Because of these, you know, senseless accusations, right? About, you know, having Venezuelan gangs in an apartment building and just this criminalization of a community that really, you know, are just here to work, right? They're just here to raise their families and become part of their communities, right? And so we've just been seeing this tremendous amount of fear and just wanting to know how they can make it better. So that's really what we've been seeing for the most part on the ground.
You know, it's a sad reality that if anyone comes in from another country, especially if they're not white, there's already prejudice that exists. And you can see it being not really ignited by this sort of thing, but spread by it. Can you give us a little idea of what the Venezuelans in Colorado were putting up with before? Just, you know, the standard issue rhetoric, the racist rhetoric and behaviors before all this ignited. What was the day-to-day life like?
Absolutely. I mean, for anyone that comes in as an immigrant, right, in any capacity, it's always a challenge, right? It's a new country. You don't know the language. You don't know how the system works. You know, most of them were just trying to find a job or, you know, if they were applying for TPS or asylum, trying to find legal venues to do that, right, or finding people that would support them. And that can always be a challenge, right? And if you have kids, trying to enroll them in school, right? So there's all of that. And also just how people perceive immigrants, right? Just how they have, since 2016 and before then, right, throughout the history of the U.S., America has this tradition of scapegoating immigrants, right? And so, just those standard, right, threats and just, things that immigrants have to deal with when they come in. And so, you know, and then on top of that, having these new accusations of Venezuelans being part of gangs, right? And coming here to cause chaos and, you know, just criminalizing them. So,
Zachary, let me bring you in on this, because one of the things that we're hearing about the Haitians being targeted in Ohio is schools are literally closing down because of bomb threats. That's in addition to working, business owning, or business managing Haitians trying to run their everyday lives, and they're getting harassing phone calls, and they're getting the bomb threats too. What other ways is this manifesting?
Yeah, so what we've seen already reported out of Ohio is 36 bomb threats. Now, we think it's important here to talk about how this happens, right? Is that before, earlier this summer, there were literal neo-Nazis in Springfield trying to gin up this racist conspiracy theory online. And then the vice presidential candidate on the Republican Party ticket, his staff reached out to the government officials in Springfield, and they confirmed that, in fact, this was a lie and not true. And yet, the vice presidential candidate, a United States senator from that state, used his massive platform to spread these bigoted, racist lies that he knew were to be lies. And the public threat to public safety, the threat of political violence, the 36 bomb threats that follow are because there are political leaders engaging in knowing lies as part of a broader strategy to be able to cultivate and create the conditions for political violence and to be able to undermine confidence in American democracy. And these are kind of twin threats that we are seeing. And what we are seeing in Ohio or Colorado or many other places is that these are not isolated incidents or isolated lies, but part of a larger pattern. And I think it's really important for listeners and others who are hearing and seeing these stories to ask the question, not about, oh, let's chase down the individual facts of this particular lie or this particular case. But I think we really have to ask a broader question, is who is telling these lies and why are they telling these lies? And I think the answers to those questions are some of our largest political leaders are telling them for a cynical political own personal benefit to create fear and division in order to win political power. And that is an extremely dangerous sort of thing. The kind of the downstream consequences, like we see in these 36 bomb threats in a small town in Ohio, is not a mystery. There is a predictable pattern when political leaders engage in dehumanizing rhetoric, where they create the sense of an other, of an existential threat, that they are a threat to personal and community safety and create that other. Well, then we know from our own history and the history around the world and all of the folks that have studied this sort of thing, that there is a predictable pattern of the vigilante political violence that comes in that sort of way. And I think we have to hold our elected leaders to that accountability, that they know that this is a pattern that, of which that they are engaging in. And so what I think what we're seeing is folks on the ground, in not just immigrant communities, are facing these threats. These kinds of threats of bomb threats, the threats of political violence that we have seen, right, threaten all communities, regardless of their immigration status. And we have seen actually a pattern of domestic terrorist attacks inside this country, from the attack in 2018 in October in Pennsylvania, where a white nationalist believing racist conspiracy theories about immigrants went and murdered Jews. We saw this in El Paso in 2019, when a white nationalist believing racist conspiracy theories and lies about immigrants went and murdered Latinos in El Paso. We saw this again in 2022 in May in Buffalo, where another white nationalist went and attacked Black Americans, believing these racist conspiracy theories about immigrants. And so we know and we have witnessed the tragic, deadly consequences of this and the disruption of people's lives based around these bigoted conspiracy theories. And I think we have to ask ourselves the questions about who is promoting these ideas out into the general public and start to hold them politically accountable for those lies.
You know, you make me almost reluctant to ask Kaylee the following question, because you make a very good point that you can't just swat down one lie after another, that you have to go to the greater picture of it. But I do want to address some of the lies just to establish the truth in the situation. Kaylee, one thing that Donald Trump has repeated is that there's a gang that has been taking over apartment buildings, a gang from Venezuela, in the town of Aurora. there are residents who live in very unsafe conditions. These are not places in good repair. But those conditions aren't the result of gangs. This is something you find in almost every city. These are pockets of poverty with landlords who don't care. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yes, absolutely. And you know what? Let me start with this, saying that this type of rhetoric, right, that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have been spreading, really, you know, inspires white supremacists to threaten immigrant families, right? First and foremost, it threatens their safety. And as Zachary mentioned, right, it doesn't matter, you know, their status here in this country, right, still threatens these families and creates a lot of emotional turmoil. And so, you know, putting that first. But the facts are these, right? We firmly believe that no Venezuelan gangs have taken over any apartment building in Aurora. I think that these lies are very extremely dangerous. The facts are these families have been evicted from their homes after fighting tirelessly to gain better conditions for their apartments, right? The slumlord conglomerate CBZ, which actually is outside from outside of Colorado, has been identified for violating city codes and creating really horrible conditions for their tenants for in many cases, right? And so we believe that in order to kind of basically get away from the responsibility of fixing up these their apartments and what these immigrant tenants and the people that live there have been fighting tirelessly to make their conditions better, they decided to instead feed into this, you know, xenophobia, into this fear that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are creating. And as we know, it's been debunked, right? That no gang has taken over at all. Let me reiterate that. Instead, these families have been forced to leave their homes and have been forced to relocate instead of having, you know, holding this landlord accountable for their lack of responsibility and their lack of making a safe home for these tenants.
Can you talk to Kaylee about what kind of response you're seeing from the public in general? If I'm living there and I'm an immigrant and I'm experiencing this kind of day-to-day horror, will I find any support from the average citizen? Are people unafraid to speak out and say this is wrong?
We've been really on the defense as a coalition, right? I think we've been working towards creating this more positive narrative, right? Because it seems like in the past few months, this national conversation has really shifted towards blaming immigrants for a lot of the things that have happened. And so we've been really working hard towards that, right? We have a lot of allies and our coalition is big and it's statewide, but that doesn't, you know, eliminate the fact that this information has really spread, right? This misinformation. And so we're really working towards that. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're there to support families and immigrants who are here first and foremost, right? Making sure that they know that they have support and that there are people fighting for them, right? Whether that's at the local level, like what I do, or at the state level, or really creating a new national narrative, right? That doesn't put the blame on immigrants, but instead, you know, goes back to this idea that, you know, the U.S. has a long history of immigration, and a lot of these people, including myself, right, as an immigrant, we came here to find opportunities, right, and to just, you know, we're part of this nation's fabric. We are part of your communities, and we, you know, we went to your schools, we work in your in this country, and so just reiterating that, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Zachary, let me come back to you and talk about what's happening on a national scale. Is there any upswelling of support for these targeted people?
Yeah, I think we've actually seen that on the local level as well. I mean, there's been lots of reports about community members surrounding the immigrant communities that are under attack, because I think the American people are at large. Like, we like our immigrant neighbors. We like our immigrant friends. We like our immigrant family members. We like our immigrant coworkers, right? And we understand that they are a part and deeply woven into the American fabric. And I think when we see these outside influencers, like the neo-Nazis that came to Ohio to stir up this sort of trouble, right? Or we see national political figures looking to take what are challenges that local communities face and to blow them up into a situation where they are using bigoted and nativist lies for their own political ends, mm-hmm. right? I think folks can really understand that, oh, we're not actually here to protect our community, to make our community more safe, to make it more prosperous. Because I think what's important, to, like whether it be in Ohio or in Springfield, Ohio, or many other places around the country, that immigrants are an essential part of a thriving economy that is essential for working families all across this country. And I think really what we need to think about here, right, is that these racist lies are not actually about solving the very real challenges of dealing with forced global migration. Mm-hmm. That is not just a U.S. problem, but is a global problem, right? None of this is about actually dealing with those challenges in the best interest of the American people, that it provides safe, legal and fair pathways for folks to enter the United States, to be part of that American fabric. Like, that is not actually what we're talking about here. Instead, we are hearing a villainization, a dehumanization of immigrants for a political process to win votes and to create the conditions where we dehumanize a group of people, many of which have been living in the United States for over a decade without a pathway to legal status. And we create that sort of lies and that dehumanization to create policies that also hurt the American people. Whether that be the lies that immigrants are polluting the ballot box so that that lie can be cultivated to question again the election results in 2024 if it doesn't go Republicans' way, or whether it's the lie and the racist dehumanization that spurs the sort of bigoted political violence like we are seeing in Ohio but have seen all across the country, or whether it's the bigoted lies that they are an existential threat to create the conditions to push forward radical extreme policies of mass deportation that would separate millions of American families who have spouses and kids who are U.S. citizens, to round them up with a show me your papers force, putting folks in camps, deporting dreamers. That is the signature policy issue of the Trump campaign. And I think we saw that, right, in those mass deportation now signs being waved at the RNC.
Right.
And so I think that it's important for us to start to understand that the lies and the dehumanization, like we are seeing in targeted at Colorado, targeted at Ohio, right, those are not divorced from creating the conditions for the trying to create the conditions for the American people to say, actually, we should start these sort of mass roundups. And whether that means, you know, we are limiting access to U.S. citizens' right to vote with some of these lies, whether it means threatening public safety with some of these lies, or whether it means wrecking the economy for working people with some mass deportation effort, right? The consequences of these lies don't just hurt the immigrant community. They hurt all of Americans.
Well, let me take that over to Kaylee, because Kaylee, I'm sure that some of the people that you're talking to within your organization have a very deep fear of being deported. Is there any legal way for people who were admitted under the TPS, who were welcomed in by the American government, do they have legitimate fear of deportation right now, or so far are we looking at just rhetoric?
I think, you know, this fear of deportation is not, you know, singled out to those with TPS, right? But that is a big fear, right? If Donald Trump does come in, you know, the administration and executive branch has the power to take TPS away, right? So it's not necessarily a, you know, something that is permanent for them, right? There's a really big fear. People, you know, they're new to this country. They hear about, you know, these, like Zachary was saying, people holding up signs like mass deportation now, right? These things, right, that people, you know, we take seriously, right? As a, you know, as a person with DACA myself, I experience these things, right? Even though I understand, right, that I have some sort of safety net, it still doesn't eliminate that fear, right? You know, these lies being amplified by media outlets and social media, you know, just, you know, this misinformation just being so amplified at the national level just creates this sense of fear, right? That at the end of the day, it's your personal safety, it's your family, that goes beyond, right? Like what really, you know, what's happening legally, right? It's just this inherent fear that a lot of us immigrants carry in this country.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break here, and after that, we're going to be taking your phone calls as well as continuing with our third guest. Our phone number for your calls is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts as you read about these stories in the newspaper and hearing about them on podcasts, on radio? What are you thinking can be constructively done about tackling this level of rhetoric? Do you have experience with this sort of rhetoric aimed at yourself, at your family members, at your loved ones? Call 866-798-8255 with any of your thoughts and opinions as we discuss this alarming rhetoric against two of our communities that have been welcomed here in the United States. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You're listening to Kaylee Leon, North Regional Organizer for the Colorado Immigrants' Right Coalition, and Zachary Mueller, Senior Research Director for America's Voice and America's Voice Education Fund. This is your call on KALW. I'm Angie Kerr. We'll be right back. And again, this is your call. We welcome your phone calls at 866-798-8255. As I welcome our third guest, Professor Jennifer Machia, will be talking about why these statements we're talking about from Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, neo-Nazis, etc., these have been repeatedly debunked. Nobody's eating pets. There are no gangs that have taken over in Colorado apartment houses. It's just not true. But even though they've been repeatedly debunked, they still seem to have so much power. Jennifer is an award-winning professor in the Department of Communications and Journalism at Texas A&M. She writes about American political discourse, especially as it relates to democracy. Jennifer has published three books: Founding Fictions, The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency, and Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. Jennifer, we just heard the words genius and Donald Trump at the same time. Thank you for that little moment. Oh, she's going to be joining us in just a moment. So let me continue over here with Zachary. Let me ask you about something that, frankly, I'd like to set the stage for Jennifer. Back in 2016, no one less than Anne Frank's stepsister compared Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. She made the statement at the time of a Holocaust remembrance that this is the sort of danger we've been setting ourselves up for. And we've heard that Trump-Hitler comparison now for the better part of a decade. You were making reference, Zachary, to the othering of people, to making people scapegoats for what's happening in our larger society. And I wonder if you find this level of comparing it to Hitler, if that has any power, or just through its constant use, whether it's now being discarded. What's your experience?
Yeah, I think that's a really difficult question to answer, and I think the one to tackle, right? I think there is a reality that there is this parallel between the style of rhetoric, the language, the clear echo. And this isn't just advocates or even people who study this in particular that have been raising these alarms. Like, this is continually being highlighted by legacy media outlets whose job it is to look at the facts and parse these. And clearly there has been a documented pattern, and it's been increasingly so through this particular campaign, about the overlap and the parallel between some of the kind of Nazi and fascist rhetoric that has been used in the past and that is being used in this campaign. Whether or not that is the most successful political message, or that people will put it aside, I think is one question, right? And I do think I am hesitant to use those comparisons. But what I do think it is important for listeners here of this program to start to think about is whether or not you want to parse out to say that those things are, that you agree 100% with that comparison or not. I think it's important for us to really think about that is a credible comparison that is being made in level. And what does that mean for our political conditions? How do we think about our political choices and actions over the next several weeks and months in light of that fact? It is important to see that, elements in history never show up exactly the same way, but they show up slightly differently, but they echo some of that history. And I think if for the folks that are believe in American democracy, believe that we can continue to reform our process to make it more fair over time, that we believe in this idea, right? I think we have to ask the question, really, that if rhetoric is being used that otherizes, that dehumanizes, for the purposes of undermining faith and confidence in an American democracy, I think we have to think about it in that context. And so I think whether or not that's the kind of comparison that any individual will want to make, the fact that it is being a legitimate comparison, I think should really give us serious pause about what is on the table here and what it means for the continuation of the American democratic project.
And before we go to Jennifer, Kaylee, I want to get your thoughts on the same thing about the power of rhetoric to either engage people in this battle or to perhaps say, well, you know, you compare the guy to Hitler, you're just way over the top here. What kind of rhetoric do you find is helpful in engaging the spirit of cooperation from people outside the immediate situation?
Absolutely. You know, I think, you know, what Zachary mentioned, I think there's a lot of legitimacy to what was said, right? But I think right now it's important to realize that we have to stand together, right? And, you know, to make it the least cheesy it can be, but we have to stand together, right? As a community, as a nation, as people, like Zachary mentioned, that believe in democracy, right? Against these false narratives. It's important for us to realize that we have to amplify the truth, right? And support those who are being unjustly targeted, right? Whether that's immigrants in your community, whether that's even, you know, just realizing if someone's talking about misinformation, maybe explaining that that's not the truth, right? Really amplifying what we know is true right now, and that's that immigrants are being scapegoated, which is, you know, an American tradition that is something that is so inherent to the U.S. and has for history, right? History will tell us again and again. And I will reiterate that this moment calls for solidarity. Let's, you know, if we can, let's reject the politics of fear and instead work together towards building a community that where we're all treated with dignity and respect, right? Something so simple that immigrants here in this country deserve, right? Everyone deserves at this moment, regardless of where they came from, right? Because mm-hmm. our communities, our immigrant communities specifically, are hurting right now. And I think that that should be centered when we talk about immigration also, right? These are real people with real emotions, with real fears. So just want to remind listeners that.
All right. Thank you for that. We're going to go to Jennifer Murcia, who has joined us. And in fact, Jennifer, let's give you a little bit of an entree here. I want to turn to Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. This is a clip from CNN. Dana Bash is interviewing Vance about this cats and dog rumor that they will not let go away. Let's hear that.
Before Donald Trump talked about eating dogs and cats on a debate stage, it was you, Senator, who first elevated this baseless rumor. These are your constituents. So why are you putting them at risk by continuing to spread claims about Haitian immigrants, despite officials in your state saying that there's no evidence and pleading for you to stop?
Well, Dana, first of all, what's putting the residents of Springfield at risk, which was a town completely ignored by the American media until Donald Trump and I started surfacing some of these concerns, is that they can't afford housing, they can't afford health care. The schools have been overwhelmed, the hospitals have been overwhelmed, and they're overwhelmed because Kamala Harris allowed 20,000 Haitian migrants to get dropped into a small Ohio town of about 40,000 people, and it's completely overwhelmed the services. Now, you ask, why have I talked about some of the things that I've been talking about? Let me just say this. My constituents have brought approximately a dozen separate concerns to me. 10 of them are verifiable and confirmable, and a couple of them I talk about because my constituents are telling me firsthand that they're seeing these things. So I have two options, Dana. I can ignore them, which is what the American media has done for years to this community, or I can actually talk about what people are telling me. And of course, many of the things that the media says are completely baseless have since been confirmed. For example, I was told, Dana, that by the American media, that it was baseless that migrants were capturing the geese from the local park pond and eating them. And yet there are 911 calls from well before this ever became a viral sensation of people complaining about that exact thing happening. So my attitude is, listen to my constituents. Sometimes they're going to say things that people don't like, but they're saying things that people don't like because their town has been overwhelmed, and it's my job to try to fight for them and to protect them. Kamala Harris opened the border, and now these people are suffering. That's what I'm focused on, Dana.
Jennifer Murcia, let me welcome you in. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, no one's goose is being cooked. This is utterly untrue. We're hearing it again and again. And we've heard, too, as I mentioned earlier in the hour, J.D. Vance said earlier that it's okay to tell these stories to get the American media to pay attention. Now, we heard from George Lakoff years ago that fighting non-facts with facts, fighting untruths with facts, was not necessarily a productive way to go about it. So, Jennifer, as someone who specializes in rhetoric, what do you think when you hear this stream of uninterrupted lies, even though they have been debunked?
Yeah, it's a common strategy on the extreme right, which is to use what old-timey propaganda scholars call the Gish Gallop, which is, like you said, just a string of non-facts. And when there are so many things that are said sequentially like that, that add up to a kind of story, it's impossible to fact check every single one of those things, to interrupt the person and say, no, wait, not that. No, not that either, not that. And so people who use the Gish Gallop are very effective at conveying the appearance of telling the truth when they're not.
Mm-hmm. One thing we were discussing just as you came on is how to effectively debunk some of this and also to warn where that has gone historically. And as I was asking our other two guests, you know, there is that danger of saying this is the way it went in 1920s and 30 Germany when people were othered, specific races were called out as less than human, as being inherently dangerous, as being inherently evil. Look what that led to. And you can be called an alarmist, or you can be thanked for pointing out the obvious. So talk about the power or the lack of power in making that sort of comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a way to communicate for democracy. There's a different way of communicating for fascism. And the way you communicate for fascism helps to create the conditions by which fascism will flourish. And that's what Hitler did. That's what Mussolini did. That is, frankly, what Donald Trump has done over the past 9 years. And so it is not anti-democratic, right? It is actually democratic to point out that anti-democratic communication strategy exists and is being deployed against a nation. What I mean by it creates the conditions under which fascism flourishes is when you're using threats of force and intimidation, when you are spreading panic and using fear appeals, reifying people, treating them as objects, and specifically as hate objects. Historically, around the world, it doesn't matter time and place, that leads predictably to genocide, to civil war, right? It creates the conditions under which people believe that fascism and authoritarianism is the only solution, right? That the world is so chaotic, things are so scary, that we must therefore give our power to a strong leader who will supposedly save us from all of these problems. It's never true. Fascists are always con men, and their fear appeals, unfortunately, are very effective.
Tell me what's happening in terms of how rhetoric influences those who previously had been openly opposed to Donald Trump and suddenly have lined up behind him to give him support and to try to get others to give him support. Does that show the power of his rhetoric, or are there other things at work there?
You know, I'm not sure that there are those people or how many of them there are.
A lot of them are in Congress.
Oh, okay. Well, So I live in Texas, and in a conservative part of Texas, and even my neighbors who voted for Trump in 2016 didn't vote for him in 2020. So I see him losing appeal more than I see him gaining appeal. Mm. But what he has done, and this is what authoritarian leaders always do, is consolidate power. They run people out of their party. If you are someone who is deemed disloyal or not quite vocal enough in your praise, you know, of the strong man, of the strong dear leader, then you are suspect. And so then, of course, you get primaried here, you know, in our system. You would get primaried, you'd get run out of office. Donald Trump is very consistent, really, at rewarding his friends and punishing his enemies. And so if we're seeing more people more vocally support him in Congress, that's why.
This makes me really curious to take this over to our other two guests. Let me reintroduce them in case you're just joining us here on Your Call. My other two guests are Kaylee Leon, North Regional Organizer for the Colorado Immigrants' Rights Coalition, and Zachary Mueller, Senior Research Director for America's Voice and America's Voice Education Fund. Kaylee, this is fascinating to me to hear how people within a power structure, for example, within the Republicans or within a group of politicians, how they react to the voice of a strong man. And I wonder, when the Colorado Immigrants' Rights Coalition has had to approach politicians and or specifically Republicans, what kind of response do you get from them in terms of, let's say, their sincerity, in terms of their willingness to buck what is going on? What's your experience with the politicians you interact with?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting what was said earlier, right? Because we've been seeing that with the Democratic Party, right? They've been shifting from, you know, politicians we thought of as immigrant allies, people that had supported us in the past, whether that was with DACA, Dreamers, anything like that. We've been seeing them shift more to the right on immigration, right? Even with Kamala Harris at the debate, mentioning constantly securing the border, right? This aspect of making, you know, the country safe and securing these borders that we have, right? And this is language that we hadn't really previously seen when we were working with allies, right? And so I think at this moment, it's crucial for elected officials and even community leaders, right? And all of us to really speak out against this misinformation, right? And support Venezuelan families have been targeted, right? Because this shift towards a more language of securing our borders and more right-leaning immigration policies and call for immigration safety and securing our border is really damaging our communities, right? Instead of supporting us, right? At this moment, we don't see a real path towards citizenship for anyone at this moment. We are really, as an organization, fighting these narratives that are coming out, right? We're not really in a position to play any offensive moves, right? So I really call on our elected officials to be brave, right? And to stand up against this misinformation that's spreading.
All right. And Zachary, let me bring the same question over to you.
Yeah, I think to your other question, right, I think what we're seeing inside of the Republican Party, right, is there is the kind of radicalization that's coming from the rhetoric that builds slowly over time. You know, we didn't get here overnight. We get here by slow an erosion of one rhetorical statement that pushes the line a bit to say, okay, we can go a little bit further the next time we're out here. And I think what we're seeing here, right, is we it's either a get on board in sort of the radicalizing, mass radicalization that's happening inside the Republican Party, or they are pushed out. I think there are plenty of people that are being pushed out. I mean, I think very clearly in the most clear example, right, is somebody like Liz Cheney, who has been a diehard Republican her whole life, who has been pushed out of the party because of her defense of American democracy. But at the same time, you have J.D. Vance, who is representing a different part of the Republican Party, who has shifted their opinions over time, part of this radicalization that happens slowly but surely, as there is a lack of severe political consequences for those engaging in this sort of rhetoric, who have adopted one thing after another. Like, we can think back to actually in September or October of 2021, when when he was running as a senator, J.D. Vance was talking about Haitians as a quote-unquote invasion, echoing the same white nationalist conspiracy theories that have motivated multiple domestic terrorist attacks. And so, but then, you know, that kind of slow rhetorical bit where it goes from a border crisis to a literal invasion, right? That may seem like a subtle move of rhetoric, mm-hmm. but it is an indicative of the fact that we are seeing that sort of radicalization that begins people to be more and more comfortable with saying more and more extreme, dehumanizing, and ugly things like we are hearing around the lie, the racist lies around Ohio and other places. And that sort of radicalization is happening here. And I think we need to be aware that while part of this effort, right, is to slowly normalize these conditions through the rhetoric so that it creates the level of dehumanization so that we create policies that harm those communities directly, but also have downstream effects to other all the rest of working families in the United States, whether that be about attacks on the economy from mass deportation, whether it be about restricting access to the ballot box via lies that immigrants are polluting the ballot box, or whether it be about the political violence stemming from those racist lies, right? That there is a process here, that there is going back to the who and the why they are telling these lies, and those lies are part of the power to get access to power, and a bit of part of the mass radicalization that's happening of one step at a time. And I think we can see and be really concerned that this might not be people goose-stepping in the streets, you know, tomorrow. But I think we need to raise the alarm bells that we are on a very dangerous path that I think through history, not just through, you know, the history in the 30s with fascism and others, but lots of other places around the globe and inside the United States, where we see once you head down this path, it is a very dark path, and it's a path that really threatens the idea of democracy. And we need to raise those concerns before we get too far down that path.
And there's a thread in there, Zachary, that I want to pick up with Jennifer. Very briefly, I want to acknowledge a caller who had a question that others may have as well. Jennifer referred to the Gish Gallup, that is G-I-S-H. Gish Gallup is where, within the debate particularly, you throw out so many arguments, often falsehoods, one after the other, that it's impossible for your opponent to attack them all or to refute them all. And then you can say, well, I won because he didn't attack ABC. So that's a Gish Gallup. Jennifer, I want to pick up with you the thread that Zachary just gave us, which is this gradual evolution from what we used to call dog whistles, where it was very subtle and there was a plausible deniability built in, where you say, well, you just said something racist. No, I didn't. I just said XYZ. That's not racist. Now we've gotten to where dog whistles are something of a distant memory. Now we're hearing overt racism, overt hatred. Can you talk about that evolution?
Yeah, and I really liked what Zachary was saying. And just to sort of add a little bit to that, part of what we never talk about when we talk about a news story is the frame wars that are happening around that story. So an issue like the border, for example, is so fascinating to me because of the frame warfare. On the one hand, you have Republicans, and these are folks that have learned to say this from the extreme right-wing fringe that has taken over the party. You know, when I was studying white nationalists in 2015 and 2016, this was the discourse they were pushing mm-hmm. on their websites. So that discourse will frame the border like we've been talking about, as an invasion. So even when Vance says, you know, that the Haitians were dropped into Springfield, you know, that's using a metaphor that associates it with an invasion. Whereas a more neutral framing or even a more left-wing, you know, democratic framing might be to say that there's a humanitarian crisis at the border. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, if you think of what's happening at the border as a humanitarian crisis, that means that the policies that you think would be appropriate would be things that provide care, right? We should bring diapers and baby formula and tents and water, and we should, you know, solve the problem by facilitating the process of asylum seeking and the legal, you know, entrance into the nation. Whereas, if you only hear about the border as an invasion, then the policies that you think would be appropriate to that are all war metaphors, right? They're all things like we need to bring the military, we need defenses, we need walls. Mm-hmm. And so the frame that we use, whether it's an invasion or a humanitarian issue, is incredibly powerful. It determines not only how we think about it, but what policies we think are reasonable. And it frames also how we think about other people's policies, right? So if you're hearing that it's an invasion and the other side is saying we need to bring water and diapers and tents, they sound insane to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's very incompatible, and it makes the problem solving in this country all that much more difficult. And so really, these issues are decided by these frames that we use to discuss them.
Is there, within that explanation, is there the idea that the rhetoric that is hotter, if I can put it the way, the rhetoric that is hotter and more appeals to the gut than the brain is the more powerful of the two?
Well, we are always attracted to certain negative emotional things, right? So outrage, there's lots of research about how outrage is more attractive, circulates more quickly on the internet, how people learn from the algorithms to circulate outrage, even if they don't feel it, right? The right-wing media ecosystem absolutely runs on outrage. Fear appeals can actually hijack our amygdala, make it more difficult for us to process information rationally. They set us off in a fight or flight mode that makes it so that we're easily manipulated and that we want to act more than we want to reflect. And so there's lots of different, you know, sort of very manipulative emotional states that rhetoric can tap into. And when it does that, it exploits those natural vulnerabilities that we have, and it makes it much more difficult to come to a rational decision.
Kaylee, let me tell you. Oh, please, go ahead, Zachary.
Just to jump in here real quick, but I think that is exactly correct. But I think the other thing that we have to think about here in this moment is that the Republicans have been pushing this anti-immigrant strategy to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. What we tracked so far this year is over $500 million being spent on anti-immigrant attack ads from Republican-aligned campaigns just this election cycle. It's $500 million with a B. It's a massive effort to be distributing these ideas to the American people. But they've tried this strategy over the last several election cycles. And while there is a real concern about people's embracing of the fear, for a segment of the American public, the kind of MAGA base, it is working with them, it is radicalizing them, it is mobilizing them. But for the vast majority of the American people, as we've been seeing in their actual votes, are not falling for this bait. They understand that this is a demonization of their friends, their neighbors, their community members, their loved ones, and they are not falling for that debate. Yes, there is, people have concerns about wanting a safe, orderly, and legal process at the border. But I do think it's important for us not to just throw up our hands on some of this stuff, as it can be easily done to say that the politics of fear are really effective, because they are. But I also think the politics of rejecting that in the embrace of American democracy have been working. And I do think there's an opportunity here for the American people. I think we are in, you know, National Voter Registration Day the other day, that there is a moment here where regular working class people all across this country are doing the heroic work of participating in our democracy, which are moving past any barriers or fears. And that's in the naturalized U.S. citizen immigrant community, that is in different communities of U.S. citizens across this country, which are doing that heroic work, standing up to this real threat to American democracy and saying, no, we actually believe in it, and we're going to do that work. And so I do think there is an important part here where regular people are actually pushing back against these leaders who are threatening our democracy in real ways. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that over the coming months, and seeing that actually the overcoming of the fear is the rage and the anger and the belief that we need to defend our democracy. And I think that is also a very powerful sense of emotion that we can tap into and think about for the protection of American democracy.
Kaylee, that gives you the last chance for the last word, and I wonder if you share Zachary's optimism.
Absolutely. I think most recently we had a community forum, right, at CERC just yesterday, at our organization, and we really heard interest from people, right, wanting to dispel this misinformation, wanting to really hear the story, like from immigrants, from our community. So I think while there is this insane national rhetoric, right, trying to scapegoat immigrants and really calling upon the criminalization and spreading fear and divisiveness in our country, I think that is a really valid point, right? There are people out here in this country that want to continue this tradition of democracy, right? Want to continue, you know, not falling into this radicalization from the right and Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, right? That want to listen to our community and want to know how to help, right? And so I really call upon people to realize that this is a moment to unify ourselves, right? Instead of falling into this divisiveness, to really help out our community, listen to your neighbors, understand that the immigrants here are here for, you know, to better this country, right? They're not here to take away. In fact, they're here to contribute financially, you're here to contribute to your communities. And that's really all that we want, right, at the end of the day. And so I really call upon listeners and anyone in this country to really understand that this is a moment to come together, right?
And there I have to leave it, Kaylee. The clock has caught us, but I thank you so much. That's Kaylee Leone, North Regional Organizer for the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition, talking to Zachary Mueller, Senior Research Director for America's Voice and America's Voice Education Fund, and Jennifer Murcia, Professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at Texas A&M University. Thank you so much for tuning in. Savannah Harriman-Pote helped produce today's show. Kevin Vance is the power behind the board. I'm Angie Coiro, and this is Your Call.